Back to Back. Now we have back-to-back tracks from a local band. This week we have Underdogs. Underdogs are a five-piece guitar-based band in Preston whose main influences include The Smiths, U2, Coldplay and Oasis. Support has come from Channel 4, BBC Six Music's Tom Robinson and XFM's Clint Boone, who named their Stop to Think demo as his record of the week. Recent shows have included supports with The Twang, Future Heads, Twisted Wheel, Bromhead's Jacket and the Northwestern Ex-Hope of the States. In the year 2009, the band were approached by producer Sean Genocchi, the Manic Street Preachers, Suede and Star Sailor, to work on some of the new recordings at Livingston Studios and Black Dog Studios, London, which saw the self-release of the band's debut single, Angel on Your Shoulder, which is now available. Underdogs also host a popular English gentleman's drinking club night at the Mad Ferret in Preston. The first song tonight is The Blue Light, and back to back that is I See Eclipses 1.
So Jean, Janae, where will you rest? The blue light only means one thing. The blue light only means she said all that she had to say, and then she still had to explain. The blue light only means one thing. But I saw you. I talked to reality, and I didn't like what he had seen. Had seen, he had seen. I said sunlight in the morning could make all the difference to your day. All the voices always came. Oh!
for Mother and Child, a United Nations radio feature to mark Human Rights Day 1975, the 27th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Have you ever heard someone say, "Kids are kids, children are children, they should be seen, not heard," or something like, "Young and tender, immature, and no discretion. Are kids just only kids?"
We may be young and not full grown, but we have problems of our own. Kids are people too. Oh, wackadoo, wackadoo, wackadoo. And though we're small, we do our best to do our thing just like the rest.
Children are people too. In fact, they are a special people. This is why, 11 years after it had adopted a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a Special Declaration of the Rights of the Child.
The United Nations General Assembly, on November 20, 1959, unanimously adopted and proclaimed a Declaration of the Rights of the Child, affirming that mankind owes to the child the best it has to give, and stating in 10 principles the special safeguards and care that all children need and deserve.
For example, the declaration says,
"The child shall in all circumstances be among the first to receive protection and relief. The child shall be protected against all forms of neglect, cruelty, and exploitation. He shall not be the subject of..."
No father, no mother. I have an uncle, don't I?
The child has a right to life.
I have a grandfather, and he'll prevent me from dying because he has a hospital.
R, B, C, D, E, F, G.
The child is entitled to receive education, which shall be free and compulsory, at least in the elementary stages.
Cinco, seis, ocho, nueve, diez, once, diez.
The child shall have full opportunity for play and recreation, which should be directed to the same purposes as education.
I'm going to tell you a joke. Pete and Repeat sat on a fence. Pete fell off, and who was left?
Repeat.
Oh, brother, you're making me repeat it all over again.
Let's see.
The child shall enjoy benefits of social security. Fine. He shall be entitled to grow and develop in health.
Go ahead.
Again?
How can one make education compulsory when there are not enough schools to begin with? What does the right to good health mean when there are only a few hospitals and doctors? How can children play and enjoy recreation when they are starving or weak and undernourished? Well, this is why UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, for almost 30 years now, has been assisting governments throughout the world to make the life and livelihood of children much better. UNICEF not only has its own programs, but also works closely with other agencies of the United Nations. As we hear from the head of UNICEF, a lot still has to be done to help the children of the world enjoy their right to health, their right to education and food, and so on.
Despite all the development efforts of the past three decades, the needs of children in vast areas of Africa, Asia, and Latin America are greater today than they have ever been. In urban slums and scattered rural communities, 85% of these children have no organized health care. In rural areas, a similar percentage are without any sources of safe drinking water. Less than half of the children in the worst-off countries are even enrolled in primary schools. And in some areas, the proportion drops to one-third or one-sixth.
The Executive Board of UNICEF has appealed to the UN General Assembly to take into consideration the situation of children and do something to help them, especially now at this time of world economic problems. As we hear from the Secretary General of the International Catholic Child Bureau, the rights of many children in the developed nations of the world need to be fully realized too.
Such needs are those related to the rights of the child,
the legal status of the child, the respect due to the person of the child, the total development of the child, including the development of his cultural identity and moral values.
The UN General Assembly has been discussing the possibility of a worldwide observance of 1979 as an International Year of the Child, so as to increase public awareness of the needs of children everywhere. Speaking of children, especially small children, one cannot help thinking of mothers and motherhood.
Do you have a mother?
I do have a mother.
She's nice.
My mother.
They're special. Mothers. All of them are special.
I know what I think of mothers.
What?
They're nuts.
I won't tell you.
You have to. If you won't tell, that means you don't know. means you're lying.
Well, you do know?
I only know one thing. You shouldn't lie to your mother. Of course. God doesn't like that.
Whether a mother straps her baby to her back while she pounds manioc in her backyard for the family dinner, or whether she rocks her baby to sleep in a pram or a cradle, a special relationship exists between mother and child.
It's that time again. It's exactly 5:15. Today, at 5:15, we're going to discuss child poverty in the United Kingdom.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.
The mission to eradicate child poverty in Britain by 2020 has been a cornerstone of Labour Party policy since Tony Blair set out in 1999. Quote, our historic aim, that ours is the first generation to end child poverty forever. The government would, he promised, break the cycle of disadvantage so that children born into poverty are not condemned to social exclusion and deprivation. Gordon Brown later echoed the commitment, describing child poverty as a scar on the soul of Britain. Well, the question is, have they done that? So let's just keep it nice and simple then. We, the United Kingdom, are the fifth richest country in the world. We have a population of approximately 60 million people, and there are about 10 million children in this country. The key facts about child poverty in 2009 is that 3.6 million children are living in poverty in the UK. The proportion of children living in poverty grew from 1 in 10 in 1979, and then with the Conservative government in power, went to 1 in 3 in 1998. Today, 28% of children in Britain are living in poverty. The UK has one of the worst rates of child poverty in the industrialised world. The majority, 52%, of poor children live in a household where at least one adult works. 45% of poor children live in a household headed by a lone parent. And the majority of poor children, 55%, live in a household headed by a couple. So what is the problem then? Oh yes, it's division and separation again, isn't it? We're the fifth richest country in the world, and that a third of the population of our children in the United Kingdom live in poverty. Well, that comes back to that old problem again about those that have and those that don't. It is the distribution of wealth, care, education, everything that is wrong.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.
This was an article in the Daily Mirror this year, and it's an article on United Kingdom child poverty, the facts. It is the bleak and disturbing underbelly of Britain, a level of poverty that disgraces the fifth richest nation on earth. New figures show that at least a third, 3.4 million children in the UK, are blighted by destitution. Their parents too poor to feed, clothe, or shelter them properly. Even the government now admits that it is likely to miss its much vaunted pledge to alleviate child poverty. The government calculates poverty as a family of four surviving on an income of £210 from which living costs need to be paid. The End Child Poverty Campaign, ECPC, says that figure misses by a mile, and it calculates that any couple with two young children and an income of £295 a week after housing costs are paid falls into the poverty trap. Works and Pensions Secretary John Hutton admits the government has to renew its efforts to tackle the problem, and will announce he is reviewing the child poverty strategy. The United Kingdom has the fourth highest level of child poverty of all 25 European Union countries, and yet we're one of the richest countries. For the first time ever, children are more likely to live in poverty than the elderly. The highest concentration of child poverty in this country is in London. 57% of families with Pakistani and Bangladeshi backgrounds are in poverty. Only Italy, Portugal, and the Slovak Republic have worse levels of poverty than the United Kingdom. To be a living wage, the minimum wage would need to rise to £7.05 per hour from the £5.35 it is today. Children who are growing up in poverty are more likely to leave school at 16. Around 52,000 families with children became homeless in 2005. Since 1999, the government has taken 700,000 children out of poverty by benefits and minimum wage. Another 300,000 would have been taken out of poverty to meet its targets. And this is the definition of whether or not you are below the poverty line. Weekly income needed after housing costs. No heating, no birthdays, no hope. Single person needs £110 a week. A couple with no kids, £201 a week. A single parent with two children, 5 and 11, £205 a week. And a couple with two children, from 5 to 11, is £295 a week.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.
In the reshuffle following Peter Haynes' resignation as Secretary of State for Work and Pensions on the 24th of January 2008, Yvette Cooper became the first woman to be promoted to Chief Secretary to the Treasury. As husband Ed Balls was already a cabinet minister, her promotion to the cabinet meant that they were the first married couple to serve as cabinet ministers simultaneously. After a number of ministerial resignations, including James Purnell, Cooper was moved within the cabinet by Gordon Brown on the 5th of June 2009 to become Secretary of State for Work and Pensions as part of his reshuffle. This woman has the responsibility to try and help these children, to lift them above the poverty line and give them equal opportunities. Well, what kind of a human being is she? For the year April 2006 to March 2007, Yvette Cooper claimed £148,421 tax-free members' allowance expenditure. Her husband, Ed Balls, claimed £157,076 of these tax-free allowances. In May 2009, it was revealed that Balls and Cooper, together, had flipped the designation of their second home three times in a 24-month period in order to fund a property portfolio. Despite being warned several times by expenses officials that their claims were excessive. So what kind of people are these people? These people that we vote in, that are the servants of the people, to help the children, a third of the children of the population of this country, out of poverty.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.
So it's over to you, Paul. Where are you?
So here we are today. It's Tuesday, the 6th of October, and it's very grey and very rainy. And I have with me Victoria. Hi, Victoria.
Hello.
Now then, so Victoria, where were you originally born?
I was born in Ukraine.
Right. And then where were you?
In Kiev City.
In Kiev City?
Yeah.
And where were you brought up?
I grew up
yeah.
In Belarus.
In Belarus?
Yeah. Really, I was born in Soviet Union, but because of Soviet Union collapsed, now I have to say that I was born in Ukraine. Where is Ukraine now? And yeah. I grew up, where is Belarus now?
Right. So, and now when did you first come to the, as it were, the United Kingdom?
First, it was about 8 years ago.
Yeah. And you got married, didn't you?
Yes, I was married here.
Yeah, and that didn't actually work out, did it, a few years ago or something. So now, but from that marriage, you had twins, didn't
twins,
you?
Twins, yeah.
You had the twins.
Yeah.
So, and they were actually born here, weren't they? So they yeah. were born here, they are British citizens.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, with British passports.
Yes.
And you yourself are a British citizen now with all the British passports and everything, aren't they? You went through all that process of being a British citizen, didn't you?
Yeah.
So do you feel now like yourself, you are a British citizen?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah? Because you and have you actually been back to Belarus in the last 8 years or have you just been here?
Mostly I have to stay here
yeah.
because my children are too little and they need lots of care.
Yeah.
And
plus they're at school.
Yeah, and they need to visit school.
Yeah. yeah.
And mostly I have to stay in here.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the best area, but not the worst. It's some days it's very nice here. Other days not as nice.
Yeah.
In other days it's maybe bad. So.
What do you think? Therefore, what's the main differences? Do you think from the people of Belarus and the people here? Or are they very similar? Do they the same types of sort of problems or whatever? Do they seem to?
It's not. It depends really on personality, I think, because there are lots of good people in England and Belarus. There are lots of people who maybe not as good in Belarus and and in here in England. It's all depends on the person. I mean, we need to say exactly not about all nation or about exactly about any definitely about any person, exactly about a person.
Yeah. So it doesn't really matter what country you're from.
Yeah.
I mean, like we both talked about anyway, we both agree that we see ourselves on this earth as being one people. We're like human citizens of this world rather than being individual people from a particular country.
Yeah.
And given that, there are good people and bad people wherever you go.
Yeah.
Is that how
you
feel?
I feel. And any nation, I think people may be quite different. Some people may be my friends and other people from the same country in the same nation, we can't be my friends, or we can't we are not able to communicate really on the normal level like friends.
But have you and your children, I mean, you basically have the full-time responsibility of your of the twins.
Yeah.
Do you feel you get much help from the or
no? No, there are not much help. It is the biggest problem of our days, because it's very difficult if you have twins or more children, and they I mean, there are lots of difficult to look after them, and there are not any help at all.
Right.
It's
and what about from your community?
In many countries.
It's the same in many
countries. In many countries, yeah.
Yeah.
You're listening to Preston FM on 103.2, the voice of the people.
Article 16. 3. The family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state.
So have you had any really bad experiences from people who might think to themselves, in their ignorance, as it were, might think to themselves that because they see you as not being English, even though you are and you're a British citizen, have you been attacked at all, or you and the children?
Yeah, mostly it's by the biggest children.
How old, about 16 or 17?
About this age, because the policy of the country tried to make young people
other people from other nations.
From other nations, and because this is the policy of the country, and many young people, they understand it, like they may attack you or to do something.
Because you had stones thrown at you and the children at once.
They may hassle you.
Oh, they give you hassle and everything?
Hassle, yeah.
And have you? They actually threw things at you?
Yeah. They may do. They throw stones, but mostly I.
Just abuse.
Mostly I would say they're just children, but they. They just grow up like this.
Yeah, but the thing is, they are only the children.
Yeah, just they affected the policy of the country. And
yeah, but it's not just. I mean, the policy of our country or the British Isles would say that they, I mean, England or the United Kingdom, compared to a lot of the countries of Europe, they do have a policy where they do try to help many, many different people. You know, coming into this country and giving them support. A lot of it, I would say, then a lot of the negative actually comes from the newspapers and the media, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And from the television and stuff like this. I mean, so the young people, when you've actually had experiences where young people have shown a lack of intelligence and ignorance, a lot of that wouldn't have come from the government. I think that would have come from the media, do you think? And of how they portray certain things. Because the children are only responding and reacting from what they've been taught and educated, haven't they?
Yeah, we can see just like in the mirror, in our what our children do, we can see it's like... children, they're like just a mirror, they show us...
They reflect what they've been taught.
Yeah.
So where are they getting that sort of attitude from? This sort of ignorant attitude, and the program that we're doing at the moment throughout Europe, there is once again, like there was in the 20s and 30s of the last century, which then led to the Second World War, because there's this global economic tension and pressure and collapse at the moment, people and countries and nations are behaving very nationalistically and taking care of number one, and that causes a lot of division and separation. And even individual people feeling in that way, that people are coming into our country and nicking our jobs or our opportunities or whatever. Do you think that's getting worse? Does it feel as if that...
Yeah, I think it gets worse. And people from different countries, they deeply misunderstood each other.
Yeah, even people from different countries.
Yeah.
So people from Poland or from Russia or wherever.
Yeah, people from European Union and people from outside European Union. Mm-hmm. They can't find the ways to understand each other.
So you don't feel as if there's any unity between the different...
Yeah, there are no any... there is no anything really friendly or just trying to understand each other, trying not to hurt each other.
Yeah.
There is nothing about it. There is nothing about kindness or to be
more human
to each other. Yes,
if they come from another country, they will generally try and take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And then if they see another group of people from a different country, do they feel like they're in competition with them?
Yeah, they can't communicate really on on normal level, like people.
Yeah.
Like normal friends.
Right. And is that
they show each other that they must be against each other. They need to be separated because the different nation.
Yeah.
So at the same time, we all live on one Earth.
Yep.
And
we're one
planet. One planet, and there are our planet has lots of problems.
Yeah.
And there are lots of problems in some areas. There is no water, no enough food for people, and so. And if we would like to have our planet, we need to try to understand each other, to be friendly to each other, stop to hurt to each other, and to think together how we can help our planet.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
There's a song that you would like us to play for you as well, isn't there? What is it?
Hotel California.
Hotel California.
California, such a lovely place, such a lovely place. said, we are all just prisoners here of our own device. And in the master's chambers, they're gathered for the feast. They stab it with their stealing eyes, but they just can't kill the beast. Last thing I remember, I was running for the door.
Do you believe that we as a people can find a solution which can help everyone equally, and we can also save the world? Do you believe we can do that for your children and the children of tomorrow? I know that you would love it to happen.
It's a difficult question.
Well, I believe we can.
I think for now we maybe need more world unions, more world agreements, and it's just real scene for now. And
but your
I'm
dream,
not sure about, I mean,
do you
capitalism, socialism, we need to be careful with any system. Because any system has different understanding. The same, like constitution, maybe written constitution, maybe unwritten constitution, and in different parts of the earth, it might be understood differently, because we need to be careful to doing everything with groups as well, because there are a lot of hustle.
Yeah, but that's only because human beings, be them individuals or as countries or nations, that's because instead of them thinking of the whole and the other and the responsibility and care
the
of
people,
the other, they're
just
thinking
not
of themselves.
They're not kind to each other. They just don't think how they may affect, how may they hurt to other person.
Well, how do we get them to understand that?
If you would like to change the world, you need to start with yourself. Everybody should start with his person first of all.
Yeah.
First of all, just sit down and think, did I hurt anybody? Did I make something wrong to anybody?
Was I selfish?
Else? Yeah. Yeah, and but when if you start with yourself, you can change anything. Of us, everybody who live on this earth, just think about it.
About others.
just think about if you hurt somebody, if I did something wrong. Just start with yourself.
Yeah.
If you'd like to change something for better, start to change yourself.
Yeah.
And it may help.
Essentially, yeah. Maybe it isn't just the where we were talking about. Some government,
yeah.
It comes down to the individual.
Because people usually, they used to watch each other people. If you can see my neighbor did something this wrong, somebody did something wrong, but why can't try to look at yourself, what you did wrong.
Take responsibility
for
yourself.
Yeah, first of all, yeah, take responsibility, start with yourself.
Don't blame the government,
yeah.
Don't blame the Pope, the Ayatollah, your neighbour.
Yeah.
Essentially, take responsibility for how you treat others upon this earth. Thank you, Victoria. This has been a great interview, Victoria, and it's been a very important one.
You're listening to Preston FM on 103.2, the voice of the people.
Article 18. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion.
So it's over to you, Paul. Where are you?
And good evening, everyone. And it's Wednesday the 7th of October, and it's 7:30. And I am at the Raza Mosque on St. Paul's Road. The mosque name, as it were, it's not the original name, is it? The original Islamic word for
it? It's masjid.
Masjid.
It is masjid, yes.
Yeah.
In Europe, masjids are known as mosque. It's a European term, but the correct
Islamic term,
spiritual term is masjid. That's
okay,
correct.
Brilliant. And I have with me Naeem, who was just speaking then.
Yeah. Assalamu alaikum.
Atiq.
Wa assalamu alaikum.
Nasir Hussain.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Basharat.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Basharat, you're the secretary of
Raza Masjid, yes.
Yes. And Nasir, you're the president of the mosque. And Atiq and Naeem, you're...
I'm a committee member, yeah.
Yes, yeah, fantastic, indeed. Now then, could Naeem, could you just explain to me, because it's quite important here as well, the actual history of the mosque here on St. Paul's Road, the Rosa Mosque?
Reza Masjid was opened December 20th, 1970.
Yeah.
It was the first unique facility of its kind to be opened in England. At the time, there was a masjid. A masjid is a term for a place of worship.
Yeah.
A madrasa is a term for a place of education, such as a school, a schooling facility. This the masjid and madrasa, the Reza Masjid and Madrasa, were opened as a unique facility, the first of its type, back in 1970 by our grandparents when they came from the subcontinent as economic migrants.
Yeah.
And they wanted to continue their practice of their faith.
Yeah.
And they wanted to pass on the knowledge, the sacred knowledge of Islam, onto obviously their children at the time, and who wanted to continue passing that knowledge on to their children and so forth and so forth.
Right. And when you, so that was 39 years ago?
That's correct, yeah.
And as we spoke earlier, you said that the, so then when it was first built, and that's the first one ever built in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
The actual reaction of the people themselves from Preston and Lancashire, that was quite a positive one, wasn't it?
Speaking to the elders over the years, the reaction of seeing a masjid initially was one of curiosity and of intrigue.
Yeah.
And there was a very good reaction. The local community engaged itself with the then elders of the Islamic community.
Yeah.
The opening of the masjid attracted media attention, local media, national media, and I believe European media.
Yeah, which it would do.
Which it would do, because it's a unique facility of its own kind, one of a kind. And the general reaction, my understanding, is that it was a very positive reaction in the community.
Right. So even though predominantly within Preston at the time, which of course is known as Priest Town...
That's right,
You know, this, so this would be the first mosque, and of course, with the architecture that's used, you know, it's the first dome, you know, it's got a lot of the original, authentic sort of architectural designs within it.
Yeah.
Surrounded, I would imagine, with, and there's still quite a lot left of, as it were, Christian churches.
Yeah.
That was actually welcomed and was celebrated in a way.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, that's a perfect attempt to put it. It was celebrated in a way.
That's fantastic, yeah.
It was celebrated more in the fact that the one that was built in the late 1800s in Woking in Surrey was actually built by a sultan, was it?
A sultan, yeah, that's
sultan.
Right.
And this was actually built by the actual migrant workers that actually came over from the subcontinent. Actually
the community, whereas the one that brother...
When did the community start growing in Preston and in Lancashire? When did the, how many, what period of time? And what
I think even before, if we look at the people from India and Pakistan were engaged in the British Army as soldiers in the Second World War, and even if we go back to the First World War, they've been always part of the British community. Because as... If we look at British history, the British Empire expanded to as far as India, and we were part of a community then.
Yep.
And when the Second World War ended, there was opportunities here in the UK for the existing people that were in the armed forces and their families, and then opportunities
and
arose.
So was all,
And rightly so, of course.
Yep.
Many Asians, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus gave their lives for Britain or for the British Empire, and so a lot of people aren't aware of this, but it's a fact. People started arriving in the 50s. In the 60s, because the economic climate in the UK had improved, and there were no workers to do the tedious menial tasks. There was no people to do the menial tasks.
Yep.
So what there was an invite to people to do menial tasks in the UK.
Which was about also good for the government, because then that boosts the...
Of course.
Much.
What they had was, they had work, but they had no workforce at the time.
Yep.
There was a migration of economic migrants that arrived in the UK. They brought with them their own culture.
Yep.
They tried in their best way to fit in with the existing culture.
Yep.
And one of the ways they fitted in, and we could see that they were fitting in, is the development of a masjid and madrasa like Reza Masjid, because obviously with the development and the building of a facility, there must have been an engagement of communities, of the Christian community, of the non-religious community and the religious community, for it to develop, because you've got the council involved, you've got the government involved, you've got a variety of communities involved. So just the result of the Masjid al-Madrasa shows an engagement of all communities. Yeah. So it must have been a good time at that time.
Right, fantastic.
Article 19. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression.
It's very interesting. So it's the masjid, which is the place of worship, the mosque itself, place of education. It's not just the education about spiritual matters, is it? It's also an education on many, many different things, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. There's a syllabus involved where children come in and the first thing that they're taught is Arabic. The concept of teaching them the Arabic is that eventually that they'd be able to read the Holy Quran. The Arabic is Arabic letters are like the alphabet basically, and they're very similar in sounds as well. What we do find is that a lot of the children that do start nursery, things like that, at the same time we'll give them the opportunity to come in the evening to the madrasa. And it'll only be for an hour or such, because obviously they're very young and they've probably had a long day at school, and then they've got the madrasa in the evening as well.
Is that every evening?
And that's every evening, Monday to Friday.
Monday to Friday,
And it'll give them the opportunity then to learn the Quran, and then from that they'll build on that, and they might go on, once they've actually started to read the Holy Quran, is to then study that. And by studying the Quran, they're studying Islamic jurisprudence, which is Islamic law. So they'll learn how to do things like wash, and in terms of praying, how they're supposed to pray. It's like the five times daily salah, the prayer that they need to pray, how they go about doing that. And they also get the opportunity of possibly learning an extra language as well, like Urdu. The Urdu language is quite common. There's a lot of literature that comes in Urdu as well, so they have that opportunity as well. And then over a set period of time, and it'll most likely be from the ages of 5 to 16, and it's roughly around the same period that they spend at school that they'll actually spend in the madrasa as well.
Right.
And if they want to go beyond that, then that's optional. That's entirely to themselves.
Indeed. Is there other things do you have? So it's still pretty, the actual educational aspects of it. It's essentially about and fundamentally about Islam and about the culture of that, or is it also about, is the discussions that take place with respect to Islam in relationship to being in England or wherever they are in the world? Is that correlation and that sort of relationship?
That's a very good point you've raised. Depending on the age and the intelligence of the child that's been educated, will depend on how much depth of knowledge that they acquire in Islam itself. What we try and teach them and what we try and give the children is a set of skills which they can take forward into the community and pass those skills on. Those skills are not just skills of a nature of acquiring a language and acquiring the faith of Islam. It's understanding,
put it into practical use. All humans.
For example, being good with their parents. Equating the value of a teacher, whether it be at school or at the masjid, or at any teacher level, whether it be a sporting teacher level, or a schooling, any type of schooling level, they equate the value of the teacher to how they would equate the value with their parents. To give them the skills of manners, to give them the skills of decency,
to give respect.
All these good values, these are the types of things that we try and pass on to these young students that we have. In turn, we expect them to behave in an exemplary manner in the community.
Whichever the
community, when I use the term community, the community as a whole, because we
world.
in the world, the community is broken down into many different segments. You can break it down into race, into creed, into color, into religion. It's all one community.
Correct.
So we try and acquire them, give them as many skills as we can for them to take into the world, and to turn them into good citizens.
You're listening to Preston FM on 103.2, the voice of the people.
Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights.
I was sent this email yesterday, and it said last week 20 Muslim graves. I mean, it's starting to get really, you know, some of these acts and stuff like this are becoming sort of quite disgusting in a way. But last week, 20 Muslim graves were attacked in the Southern Cemetery in Chorlton, an area of Manchester. Nothing like this has ever happened here, explained Abdul at a vigil at the cemetery last Sunday. It is no coincidence the English Defence League are coming to Manchester next Saturday. The English Defence League are an anti-Muslim group of thugs. They have taken their race-hate message to Luton, Birmingham and to a mosque in Harrow. The EDL tried to attack the Palestine demonstration in London last month, and they have emailed group, the Stop the War Coalition in Manchester, threatening them to keep away, and they're continuously intimidating. So now they're starting to attack Muslim graves.
Yeah.
They're continuously, I mean, sure, by the looks of it then, their aims and objective is to go to war in some way? Do they want bloodshed on the streets?
I don't think they actually want bloodshed on the streets. I think maybe their objective is to cause as much trouble as possible. But as my brother here was saying earlier, in terms of black sheep, we have in every community,
yep,
we have a middle ground and we have an extreme ground, yep, in every community.
Yep.
We find that obviously this is an extreme
reaction
or extreme, yep, action by an extreme set of people.
Yep.
What we can do for them is we can pray for them,
yep,
is one of the things. Yeah, we can pray that God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, opens our hearts and shows, what are you doing attacking graves? What is all that about?
Yeah,
it's the dead.
Yeah,
at least respect the dead.
Yeah,
if you've got something to say, go on a platform and say it on a platform.
Maybe they don't have the courage to do that.
Maybe it's possible. Maybe that's very, very accurate. Yeah. But what we do have, fortunately, in the UK is an excellent policing system.
Yeah.
And what we as Muslims have found that the police are excellent when it comes to dealing with situations like that. So we do not need to engage ourselves as a Muslim community,
yeah,
in people or with people like themselves who are behaving in a terrible manner.
In the small minority.
We believe it is a small minority.
What do you necessarily, you were going to say?
Well,
something
I think
that?
Basically some of them people like just stir things up, like, so the other community react,
mm,
and then justifies their whatever they're trying to achieve.
Well, what is it do you think they're trying to achieve?
Well, I think they're trying to achieve, like, just to get into politics and basically, you know, have their own
aims.
Yeah. I think you can ask them what they're trying to achieve.
Well, what I can do is I can just do a short
message.
A verse of the Holy Quran.
Yeah,
that would be absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Right. But what we'll do is, sorry, Des, we're just going to wind up now, mate. So I would like to, first of all, thank, it has been a great interview. Thank you all, sort of thing. Thank you to Naeem, Atiq, Nasir, and Basharat. And Basharat, you would like to, I think, say, just to finish it, a prayer, an Islamic prayer?
Yeah.
What exactly is this, the fundamental message behind this particular prayer?
This particular prayer is prayed by each Muslim whenever they offer their prayer five times a day.
Yeah.
You have units that you pray with each prayer.
Yeah.
And in each unit, this is actually prayed.
Yeah.
And it's basically, the concept of this prayer is you're praying for yourself and you're praising God at the same time as well.
Right. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
We hope you've enjoyed tonight's show, and we're looking forward to the next show. We're not sure what it's going to be about yet, but it's going to be interesting. But for now, it's good night from me, Des Butler, and it's good night from Paul O'Hara. Good night.